This podcast is a member of the Mud Puppy Games Network.
Welcome to Designers and Discourses, a podcast in which we interview tabletop game designers and discuss their influences and inspirations. On tonight's episode, we talk to James M. Ward, creator of the Metamorphosis Alba role-playing game. Welcome to episode 3 of Designers and Discourses. I'm your host, Jim Wampler. Tonight's guest hails from the very earliest days of TSR, having met Gary Gygax at a bookstore where they discovered each other's love of classic fantasy and science fiction literature. This chance meeting eventually resulted in the world's first science fiction role-playing game, Metamorphosis Alpha, which was published in 1976. Taking the assignment from Gary to go write a science fiction version of D&D, James M. Ward did just that, pioneering the genre with his game setting aboard a generational starship, the proverbial Dungeon in Space. Then in 2014, an odd thing happened. Though Metamorphosis Alpha had never been long out of print throughout subsequent various editions, one of which I had the pleasure of publishing, Goodman Games brought back the original first edition of the game in a deluxe hardback reprint, and continues to support that edition of the game with myriad adventures, supplements, and Kickstarter projects. Tonight, we'll be focusing on the sources of inspiration for that very first edition of the game, from books to movies to comics. Thank you for being so generous with your time and coming on the show tonight, Jim.
Hey, no problem, Jim. Of course, you've told my favorite story, so now really I have nothing to say.
What's your favorite story? Please tell us.
How I met Gary at the Lake Geneva News Agency.
I'm just glad to get the facts straight.
Yeah, you got the facts exactly right. We were walking down the aisles. We picked up the exact 7 books, and we thought that was very amusing. And then he told me he had a game where I could play Conan the Barbarian and fight Set, and I was hooked for the rest of my life.
Gotta get Set.
Yes.
Well, from that chance meeting, obviously, I know, but our listeners may not, you started gaming with Gary, and that led to doing some writing both for TSR and some outside writing in the game industry.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us what you were doing at that time. What was your profession when you first met Gary?
I was a substitute teacher. I had just graduated from college with a teaching degree, and I was looking in my hometown area for a job, but that didn't happen. And in 1975, I moved to Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and started teaching in a little high school called West Grant.
Nice. Well, you must have journeyed from there to play what was probably very early D&D.
Oh, yeah. Every holiday, every teaching holiday and all summer long, I would come back home and I'd play D&D with Gary and his group. I just love the imagery of it and the creativity of it. And like you pointed out, Gary allowed me. I suggested that he really needed a science fiction version of D&D. And he allowed me, for some strange, bizarre reason, to try writing it. He didn't know if I was a writer or not. He just knew I was creative.
Well, there's a timeline I'd like to try and see if we can establish, because I'm a little fuzzy on it, too. I mean, you met Gary, and then we're playing D&D with him. Did the Starship Warden start out as a level in Greyhawk in Gary's universe? And the reason I ask that is because, of course, Gary did his take on your game by doing the module Expedition of the Barrier Peaks. What was the chronological order of those events?
Okay, so I did MA, and Gary had thought about doing something like this and had made notes on a starship that crashed in his world, but he turned his idea, which would have been a Metamorphosis Alpha-like thing, into his fantasy adventure novel, science fiction fantasy adventure module that was so popular. So basically, he knew that I was working on Metamorphosis Alpha, so he turned his starship thing into a crashed starship on his world.
I loved that the stories where the characters jumped from one setting to the other. I remember you telling me when Gary passed that you have an elf stuck on Gary's version of the Warden.
I have a half-elf stuck on the Starship Warden. It makes me very sad. He's been there for 40 years. He's quite unhappy. Basically, one night, the evil Gary Gygax had us over to play D&D. And, well, while we were playing, he got up and said, Jim, please sit in my chair. Gary always had the front of the table as his DM chair. And he sat me down because we had walked through a portal onto the Starship Warden, and he had taken one of his characters and all the other characters that were playing that night, and we were all trapped on the Warden. So I had to go to my car, I had to get my Starship Warden stuff, and I had to GM everybody being introduced to the Starship Warden, and I was really wishing that I didn't die. Basically, magic always works on the Starship Warden, but the mental attacks and the other kinds of attacks that can happen from mutants always work against the fantasy characters. So very quickly on, Gary took the group and established a village, a safe haven, called the Vigilus, and of course it's still there on the ship, but my precious half-elf magic user thief was trapped there forever. I would give a great deal of money and time if someone could release him from his burden and get him back to the fantasy world where he belongs.
Well, you bring up an interesting topic referring to how the various rule sets affected characters from the other game system, which is something I adore and have been doing some work on recently myself with a different game. But what were the initial challenges to you? I mean, because the sentence, write us a science fiction version of D&D, is a very simple assignment, but it must have been enormously complex transferring D&D mechanics to a science fiction setting.
You know, it wasn't bad because I deliberately didn't transfer D&D mechanics to a science fiction setting. I tried actually very hard. I was a naive writer in the beginning, there in 1974 and 1975, but I knew enough that I wanted to have a different kind of system in Metamorphosis Alpha from D&D. I didn't want them to be the exact same system. So there are similar things like constitution and strength, but I tried very hard to put mostly 3d6 things in my charts and tables. I did do a d20 for combat, but I have since changed that over to 3d6 because I wanted to stay away from the rules and regulations of D&D, even though it looks exactly like it. In those days, there wasn't any other choices. There wasn't any alternatives. D&D had just started out. So I was able to keep the flavor of D&D without doing a lot of the same exact rules.
I love the pioneering do-it-yourself ethos of that time because... which in some ways was because of what you just said. There weren't, you know, a bookshelf full of other games to go reference. You guys were inventing this stuff.
Right. It was all happening on its own, you know, all brand new out there in the design land. And certainly other people picked up on it and started doing their own designs like Traveler and other games. But, you know, we didn't have anything to reference except for, stories on mythology. We did a lot of referencing of Greek and Roman mythology. We did a lot of referencing of the gods and their powers and abilities. Old stories and folklore was used in our making of our products.
Let me ask you a couple of particular questions about the game mechanics that you invented, what you kept, and what you changed from D&D. As a reference point at the time. Experience points and levels, one of the innovations of D&D, are entirely absent from Metamorphosis Alpha. You start out with a generous amount of hit points, but that's all you're ever going to get barring mutations and events happening. So this was a purposeful design decision, I assume.
Yes, it was. My idea was that people can become more powerful through the knowledge that they gain and the equipment that they gain, as opposed to the experience that they gain. So that was one really big difference in MA to D&D.
And obviously, those of us who've played the game know understand that that's exactly how it works. So that's working as designed and intended.
Excellent. I'm glad you approved, Jim.
Well, I mean, I've enjoyed your games for a long time, sir. Back to what you were talking about, we're taking the emphasis off the prototype of D20 mechanics and going with 3D6. Was that because you liked that system, those mechanics better? Was it just because it was easier to find D6 in the mid-70s than it was polyhedrals?
Okay, I'm going to admit a very deep, dark secret to you that no one else has ever heard.
Please do.
I couldn't figure out the poly dice. The four-sider and the eight-sider, I couldn't figure out what they did and how they worked. It was really irritating to me. It took me 7 months of playing D&D to figure things out with those dice. They were just too odd and foreign to me. And when we were rolling 20-siders, we rolled a 6-sider and a 10-sider. And if you got a 1, 2, 3, it was whatever the number was on the 10-sider. If you got a 4, 5, or 6, you added 10 to the 10-sider number. So it was confusing, and I couldn't get it, but I could really get 3D6. I got the bell curve of the 3D6 effort. I got what you needed and how hard it was to roll an 18 or a 3. I figured that all out. That was no problem. But those poly dice, for the longest time, I couldn't figure them out.
Well, I get exactly what you're talking about, even though I started later in 79. My first dice set were the Home Basics set, which I still have. And once in a while, I resort to them at the table. And a 20-something gamer doesn't understand why I'm rolling a D20 and a D6 at the same time. Are you ro- are you, I get asked, are you rolling your damage in case you hit? I'm like, no, that tells me whether it's high or low.
And you're
'Cause
not rolling a D20, you're rolling a D10.
technically, yes.
Yes. You're right. Nobody gets it these days because nobody did it. But back then, to get our 20, we had to roll a 6-sider and a D10. It seemed natural to us. It was amazing to us when the D20 finally came out.
Well, let me talk about some of the things that I personally adore about Metamorphosis Alpha and in general much of what you write, and I'll then let you respond. Metamorphosis Alpha's got its own play style. And not having been a D&D player in the mid 70s, I'm not sure how much of that is your invention, how much comes directly from D&D, but would you say it's fair to call MA's over the top play style what we would now call gonzo? I mean, there's super science, but earnest deadly danger and a high mortality rate at the same time.
Well, I wouldn't call it gonzo because as I designed the game, I just designed it as a tougher role-playing experience than D&D. Now, Gary's, and everybody, I see this a lot, especially today. They think of Gary as, of course, the father of D&D, which they should have, the father of role-playing. But they also consider him a conservative game designer and a conservative dungeon master. And he wasn't that at all. We died a lot in the old days. And he wasn't conservative about that at all. When he was playing the game in 74 and 75, he had to play test what the material was and the magic was in the game system. So, deck of many things and portals, +3 and +4 weapons, all of that stuff showed up in his game because he had to find out, how tough it really was. And so he was not conservative at all. He was a very liberal game master, and he had no problem bumping off your characters if you got into a situation where you should have run and you didn't.
Well, thank you for that, and forgive me for using what is sometimes a divisive term because everybody has their own individual understanding of the word gonzo.
Yes, absolutely. I understand.
But
I don't think Metamorphosis Alpha is gonzo. Lots of people die in the game. Gary played it for 40 years. He only had one character die in all those 40 years. His characters lived a long time because he was careful and cautious. So I've never thought of Metamorphosis Alpha as a gonzo game, as an over-the-top, kill-everything game. I made it difficult to play on purpose. The challenges in Metamorphosis Alpha are very difficult for the normal player, for the new player, or even the middle level. or middle experience player. My thoughts came from Gary's game. The world today kind of perceives Gary as a conservative, careful dungeon master, careful designer, but that wasn't the case, or that isn't my perception of the case. When Gary was dungeon mastering in 74, 75, and 76, he was actually playtesting all of the things that are in there now. He had to find out how powerful a deck of many things was, how powerful a portable hole was, how powerful plus three and plus four magical weapons were. He had no idea how they would affect a game, so we had lots and lots of magic in our games, and he learned from playing what those things did to his campaign world. And so I kind of got that attitude for the science fiction version and made my monsters very tough, made the mutations very powerful. And so certainly today when people play, they're stunned at the fact that they die and metamorphosis as alpha, because the current game systems say, don't kill off your characters. That's a terrible thing to do. But that wasn't the way I was taught by the man who made role-playing.
Well, obviously, I'm in your camp, but I see some hope for the future, because we're talking about a playstyle preference, and if you're locked into a playstyle preference where your character never dies and you and your group have fun, I've got no dog in that hunt. But with games like DCC RPG coming in that bring back that style and sensibility, I've discovered that some of the youngest players that join my table will shrug those character deaths off and roll up a new character instantly, because now they're used to a computer game where their character dies all the time.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That hasn't been my experience, but I'm glad to hear that.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the inspirations, and I think I know these from pieces of your writing that I've read, but you feel free to correct me if I misstep, and I'm going to take them in chronological publication order, starting with Robert Heinlein's Orphans of the Sky, which is a wonderful book everybody should go read immediately if you haven't read.
And, you know, I didn't read that book until after Metamorphosis Alpha was designed.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I know everybody wants to say that that was the book that inspired me, but you and I both know which one inspired me.
Yeah, we're coming to it. This is what I love about when a creator such as yourself strikes some kind of zeitgeist, and things seem to have links that you know weren't there, because in Orphans in the Sky, the protagonist is a human who quickly runs around in the ship and starts recruiting a band of followers, including a two-headed guy, as you know, Jim Joe. And that, to me, from the outside, seems like, oh, well, that's why humans in Metamorphosis Alpha get that leadership stat ability that no other characters get. It's just a happy accident.
It's just a happy accident. I needed to make sure that there was a reason to play humans in the game, and I thought that leadership stat would be one very good reason.
And segues a little from D&D's hirelings and henchmen mechanics.
Well, you know, and again, I was trying to, you're right, it does, but I was trying for something that wasn't trademarkable to D&D.
Right. Well, let's move to the book that probably did inspire the game, Brian Aldiss's Nonstop, or as we in the U.S. saw it in paperback, Starship.
Yes, that is the book that inspired Metamorphosis Alpha. I loved every bit of it. I didn't duplicate every bit of it because, again, I didn't want to get sued, and I wanted my own thing. But that Starship and how you have plants and animals in the corridors of the ship, the logic behind that inspired me in my Metamorphosis Alpha efforts. It's just a great book. Everybody should read it. And it is the Starship Warden.
We don't have to worry about spoilers on a book published in 1958, right?
That's right.
I of course read it as a younger man, but I reread it a few years ago and was struck by how there's that sort of looming menace of the giants and the outsiders to the tribal human crew that have lost most of their knowledge of where they are and what's up.
Yes.
Reminded me very much of how the androids prowl the decks of Metamorphosis Alpha.
Yes, you're right. My only wish is all my players are too smart. I've never had any dumb players. So they all instantly know they're on a starship. I should actually at maybe at conventions this next year, I'll run the game so that I don't announce it to Starship at the beginning, and see what happens. It's just the surprise in the Aldous story is missing in the gameplay generally of Metamorphosis Alpha.
Since 1976, it was probably there in the beginning.
Yes, actually no, because Gary and Brian knew that they were playtesting a science fiction game.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so no, it wasn't in the beginning either, unfortunately, and it's a surprise that's really cool and should be exposed to the players. Maybe this convention season I'll run some MAs where you don't know it's MA.
Well, I think you would have been very proud of me in the 80s, because a couple decades before I had the honor of meeting you, I managed to pull it off with my Gamma World campaign, which had just reached one of those points where it was getting a little stale. It was time to do a reboot or do something to keep the players interested. And they just stumbled across a teleportation pod in post-apocalyptic Appalachia and were transferred to, as far as they knew, just another part of their planet that was now jungle.
Oh, wow.
And it was about a month and a half before they figured out what was up.
Oh, really? That's the way I wanted to play it, but I've never had a chance to do that.
Well, Brian Aldiss is a tremendous influence from the literature, but there was something about that time frame in the 60s and 70s where the post-apocalyptic genre had more bite than, well, it's coming back in a big way now, but you know, with the nuclear arms race, everybody was thinking about it, and it seemed to permeate the media, because there were I'm interested in what you saw before you wrote the game. You obviously saw the Star Trek episode For the World is Hollow and I've Touched the Sky.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I was reading a lot of apocalyptic books in those days. There were bunches of novels out there about what would happen if civilization stopped for some strange reason. I'm thinking right now of the Stirling novels, where all electricity is taken away, and they try to survive in that world. And there was a lot of books like that, where for some reason the world had stopped. Who was it? Alfred Bester was doing a lot of disaster books in those days. You know, he did a disaster book where the wind got up to 300 miles an hour and just blew everything away. And another disaster book was where the ocean the ice melted on the ice caps and the oceans took over everything. And he just did disaster book after disaster book after disaster book. And, you know, how people survived in those disasters was a fun read. You know, that's kind of one of the reasons why we naturally went from MA to Gamma World.
Well, it's interesting to me how much you ramp things up for your own game, because in Nonstop, there's obviously a generational starship. There's many of the base premises, but then you crank things up to 11 with wild, riotous mutations everywhere. Did that come more from the post-apocalyptic literature?
You know, that came from Superman comic books.
Really?
Yes. The different colors of kryptonites that would change Superman.
Oh, red kryptonite.
Well, red is, yeah, red, but all the, like, they did multiple colors, and every single color did something weird to him. And I used that when I did my mutations.
Oh, let's see how many of these we can remember. Red was an unpredictable mutation. Gold took his powers away permanently. I can't remember the rest.
Yeah, and I can't either. But in those days, I remembered every single one, and they became my mutations.
Were you it aired in syndication very infrequently? But were you ever a fan of the Harlan Ellison conceived syndicated show, The Star Lost?
You know, I didn't start watching those till after MA was designed. Somebody said, you know, you should watch this show because it's just like Metamorphosis Alpha. So then I watched the show.
In a rough kind of way, I like your starship better.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Even though you've died several times?
I've got my game. I've survived.
Yes, you have.
It just took me a few years to ramp up my skills to survive, you know. We were talking about it the other day. You don't even want to step on the grass on the Starship Warden without checking it out first, because it's going to try and murder you, chances are.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
Well, since we were bringing up Superman comics, I have some insider knowledge of one of your favorite comics. What were some of the comic book influences on the game?
Ooh, that's an interesting question.
Because I love this stuff where Tim Cass tells me suddenly psionics came from Doctor Strange, Steve Ditko comics. That's wonderful information.
It is. You're right. And in our notes together, you quoted Magnus Robot Fighter.
I just happen to know you're a fan, and there are lots of robots to fight on the Warden, so...
Yes, I love that comic, and certainly there, that comic inspired my robot creations, but the comic, the Gold Key comic that really helped me was Mighty Samson.
Oh, right, of course!
Yeah, Mighty Samson was actually, it's Gamma World, but it's an apocalyptic time, and this is a big bruiser guy who's super strong for some reason we don't know, and he walks in a destroyed New York. And a lot of those ideas were concepts that I put into Metamorphosis Alpha.
Well, that's the shoe on the other foot. That's a comic that you would assume I had read, but I was too young when it was being published, and I just caught up with it a few years ago.
It's just wonderful.
I mean, you could steal all those cover paintings. I love that Gold Key Comics had the painted covers.
Yes, you could. And same thing with, what was it? Was it Micronauts?
Yes.
The tiny robots that were around, those covers are all magnificent, too.
Well, I admire your taste in comics, sir.
In the old days, I actually, when I had my own little company, we looked into doing the role-playing rights to Mighty Samson and Magnus, but they were selling for too... They wanted too much money for it.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
I would have loved to have done a Mighty Samson role-playing game or a Magnus Robot Fighter role-playing game. That would be great.
Oh, it's because there's a modern company that's picked up the rights to all of those, I bet.
Yep.
Valiant Publishing. It used to be. I'm not sure what it's called now.
I don't either, but that's... They're just things you're sorry that you didn't get.
Well, I have a question that I've been asking all my guests because I think it provides some insight. You were writing Metamorphosis Alpha in 1975-ish?
Yes.
What music were you listening to as you actually wrote those rules?
That's an excellent question. I'm a big Celtic guy. I listen to all sorts of Celtic music.
Was there a particular song or artist that you were beating to death?
No, not really. I just my kids and my wife give me Celtic CDs all the time for Christmas and my birthdays. And so I just throw them on. Usually they don't have... usually it's just instrumentals, and I just turn it on and get in the mood. I also do a lot of jazz. I'm a real big Benson fan, and so jazz and Celtic music are pretty much what drive me.
That's not as obvious a connection as one might have expected, but there's a certain Scott-Irish rhythm going on there that plays very well with player characters struggling to survive.
Yes, you are correct, sir.
And thank you for answering the question. I would be embarrassed probably to admit that as I'm writing Metamorphosis Alpha Adventure for your system, I tend to listen to Alan Parsons Project or the Daft Punk's Tron soundtrack.
On purpose?
yeah, right. See, I said it was embarrassing, right?
Yes. Well, that's good. It's good to have inspirational music. All of the authors that I know, you know, like to listen to music as they write. Some people don't mind words in it. Like, Margaret Weiss does not want to listen to vocals. She wants to listen to instrumentals. So I can respect that.
Well, before we wrap up design inspirations, is there anything that we haven't covered that was germane to creating the game in that time?
No, not that I think of. I find it very interesting that a lot of the stuff that they called me crazy for inventing, you know, are actually happening now.
Oh, right. All science fiction writers, it's a two-edged sword. You struggle to stay ahead of modern technology, and then you get to predict things that actually happen.
Yeah, you know, like, we have working laser pistols right now. I think that's cool. You know, I'm doing a project about Nikola Tesla, and Tesla had a death ray that he said he invented and gave the United States. So I think that's kind of interesting that we had a death ray in 1902. So it just amazes me, the stuff that we... You know, it's kind of like on Star Trek, that alarm that they have when it's going to battle stations is used by a lot of hospitals, has an alarm for something bad happening. or the doors that don't open and close like regular doors, they slide into the buildings. We have that a lot now.
I love it when this happens because in Brian Aldiss's book was 1958, and if I remember correctly, what had happened on the ship is they had colonized the world and had come back, but were being kept on the ship because they picked up some amino acid that was shrinking the people and making them live faster.
Yep.
So that's pretty advanced stuff for 1958, and you and I were talking in a phone call the other day, this brand new book that just published this year called Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson. That's almost the duplicate plot device, although Kim Stanley Robinson has infused his generational starship story with fully modern science and cosmology, and they get on the planet and there's some little folding protein that just starts wiping people out.
Sure.
I mean, you think the grass on the Warden is tough. You can't even see a folding protein coming at you.
Yeah, or the what is it? Come on, it's the little machines these days.
Nanotech.
Yeah, all the nanotech is really cool and interesting stuff, and of course, the mutated plants and things. Right, I'm kind of in a rut right now. I'm using a lot of fungus in everything I write. And people are telling me maybe I'm putting too much fungus in things. So I've kind of stopped doing that, and I've kind of gone to nanobots doing all the dangerous stuff these days.
I'm much newer to the industry than you, but I think that's standard. You find something, you work it until the kibosh gets put on it. At Goodman Games, there's a moratorium on ziggurats and tentacles right now.
Oh, are there really?
But put as many dinosaurs in as you want.
Isn't that interesting? I love putting Tyrannosaurus rexes in my products.
I know that about you. And what is it about a T-Rex, the same party of D&D players that will bravely face down a silver dragon, will run the other direction the second they see a T-Rex?
That's because they're smart.
Well, the smart ones do that.
That T-Rex has got to be almost the toughest creature in all of dinosaur land. I mean, there's a couple bigger, and certainly there's some sea creatures that are tougher, but it's a scavenger. It's not even a hunter. It scavenges off of bodies.
Hundreds of pounds of meat a day.
Yeah, I just think it's a fascinating creature, and certainly Spielberg has taken the raptor to its nth degree, and it's become a terrible, horrible monster, but it's got nothing on a T-Rex.
Well, that was that same weirdness where when Michael Crichton wrote Jurassic Park, the only raptors they had fossils for were chicken-sized, but after he wrote it, subsequently they discovered larger-sized raptors like he depicted.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I think that's neat. It's fun.
It's almost like there's a game master in the sky and we're just player characters.
I know! Yes, indeed.
Well, we touched on it earlier, the difference between player expectations in 1976 and today. Let's talk about a few of those, because we're friends and we've discussed many of these topics. I know it was an expectation of yours when you created Metamorphosis Alpha that, and in fact, it's stated explicitly in the introduction that these are the guidelines for you to create your own generational starship. You never expected that 40 years later, everybody would still be playing on the Warden.
You know, it astounds me. It really does. I thought that everybody would name their ship after their last name like I did. The Womplerin would become your starship, but nobody did. They all named their ship the Warden. I don't get it. it's an idea that I expected everybody to name their own ships, and they don't.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I have no idea. I really don't. It's I don't see why they would do it. I mean, I don't think when when they play Star Trek, that every ship they ride on is the Enterprise.
That's an excellent point.
It just amazes me that people don't name their starships after themselves like I did. They should have got the clue from what I did.
It's of interest to me because there are, the hobby is wide, and there are all different types of judges and players. And there's a group that are more do-it-yourself guys that will do their version, their current version of what you guys did back in the day, invent their own stuff. And then there are a group of players, and I'm not banging on them, it's perfectly fine, that want a whole campaign setting like the Gazetteers, where everything's laid out for them, and they run with that.
Yeah, that makes me happy because I get to sell products to them.
Well,
I like that style of play.
I mean, you guys and Bruce Hurd wrote some wonderfully crafted settings like that a judge or referee like me had no interest in, except maybe to browse and steal, you know, particular things from.
Right, steal ideas, and that's a fine thing to do. But I really have to thank Goodman Games and Joseph for their picking up of Metamorphosis Alpha. The guy gives me a call and says, "Hey, how about if I do a Metamorphosis Alpha for you?" And I said to Joseph, "Joseph, I'm already doing it." You know, I didn't want to like demean his question, but his idea of doing a what would you call it? It was called the deluxe hardbound book. His idea of doing it. He's had a name for it that was kind of like
a nice archival edition that's going to last to hand down to your kids.
I think he called it museum quality.
Yes.
Is what he did. His idea of doing a museum quality MA that had lots of other things in it, I had never thought of and would have never thought of it. So what he helped me produce is just a marvelous thing. And you're right, I know Metamorphosis Alpha, the little 32-pager would have lasted down into eternity. I think it's going to be even more likely now that 100 and 500 years from now, there's going to be Metamorphosis Alpha hardbounds out there.
I mean, that's pretty great.
It makes me very happy. I love the idea of stuff living on past me.
Well, I mean, that's both a business relationship and a creative partnership, but it's easy to see how the marriage happened because Joseph is... I think I'm probably older than him, but of my generation of players who found the hobby at about the same time, so he's very of the old school sensibilities, and a lot of what he publishes, like Dungeon Crawl Classics, has much of the same ethos as Metamorphosis Alpha.
Well, and that Dungeon Crawl Classics really has the style of what we were doing in the 70s and 80s. I really like that just because of that.
Yeah, your character died. Suck it up, Buttercup. Roll up a new one.
Exactly.
3D6 in order, the way Gary and Crom intended.
I quite agree. Quite agree.
There's we should, before we get out of here, talk about the current expansion that just had a Kickstarter this past year. And yes. Before we do that, full disclosure, I also work for Goodman Games and have written some small contributions to these projects.
Oh, you've written great products on this. You get it. I really appreciate that when an author understands it. There was a couple things that some of the other authors did that I didn't like at all, and I had to tell them not to do it. But you and Michael Curtis certainly get the MA style.
I just wanted to admit to that by way of saying my appreciation for the products in the company are genuine, not because I get a paycheck out of it.
There we go.
Because if you saw the paycheck, you'd know that.
I get those same paychecks for the stuff I write as well. So anyway, so we've gotten...
Epsilon City.
Yes, well, the MA one was last year, and Epsilon City was just maybe 2 months ago. Anyway, Epsilon City is the city the only city that was in Metamorphosis Alpha. Basically, when they were building the ship, they built the city level first, and it is just like a city, just like any other city on Earth, using the using the style, the architectural styles of the 1920s and 1930s, but it's just a big city with lots of things to do in the city, and the Kickstarter had adventures and has the city. It's never really been fully detailed and mapped out, and so that's what we're going to do. The maps of the city are like the main core of the product, and then the adventures that go into the city are what's going to get people interested. And basically, in my Epsilon City, the Wolfoids have taken over. Wolfoids are 9 feet tall humanoid wolves. And one of the problems with a Wolfoid is that it loves to eat human hands. It's a delicacy for those boys. And so they are just naturally aggressive to anything that has a human-like hand, because they want it. And so, but what's happened is that the city has impacted the Wolfoids. So in the apartment complexes, because they were going to be sailing along for many, many years, the apartment complexes have themes. So one apartment has a pirate theme. So clothes and equipment and things of a pirate nature are given to the people who live in that apartment. Well, now Wolfoids live in that apartment. So we've got clothes being designed for a 9-foot-tall Wolfoid that are pirate-like. And they're getting pistols, gunpowder pistols that work, and they're getting cutlasses, and they're being taught the pirate way. And that causes a little problem for them, because one of the main rules for the pirates on the Epsilon ship is women may not be hurt, females of any type. So those poor Wolfoids, when a group that has females in it comes and attacks, they don't know what to do about the females because they can't blow them away. So they have to capture them and take them somewhere else, which is often a very difficult thing to do. So we've got many different themes. We've got a Wolfoids in Roman gear. We've got Wolfoids in Cherokee Indian gear. We've got Wolfoids in Hun gear. So these themed apartments are all over the Epsilon City. And that's one of the things that are getting written. So you discover these, and you have to deal with these Wolfoids that are in these costumes. It's going to be a very unusual time for the players of the game.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, that's right.
I saved for towards the end of the program some harder questions that I wanted to ask, and if we touch on anything you don't want to talk about, we'll just cut that out later.
But, hey, that's not going to happen, Jim.
But I know you and I have talked, and sometimes we've talked about things that were perhaps on Wikipedia incorrectly or something like that. And
Wikipedia drives me crazy.
I have some history of the game that I think I know that I just want to ask you how much is correct or what the real story is. Metamorphosis Alpha, when it was published in 76, never got any subsequent adventures or supplements or materials, which is what is the wonderful karma of today. Suddenly today, that 1976 first edition version of the rules has cut dozens of modules and GM screens and all kinds of great stuff, which is fantastic. But back
isn't
in the
that, that's unusual and interesting, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you know, you think you see everything and then something new happens.
Yeah.
But the next game that did come out that was created and co-written by you was Gamma World, and somewhere in that fuzzy area in between, there was a Gamma World product that was going to be a repackaging of Metamorphosis Alpha called Metamorphosis Alpha to Omega. My understanding, I think from reading books like the one by John Peterson, is that mainly transpired that way as a way of TSR mitigating some of the generous royalty agreements that the initial things were signed under as it transferred from more of just a small business to a game publishing proper. Have I got that right?
No, not really. What happened is Metamorphosis Alpha came out and people liked it a lot, but instantly they were really flooded with mail that said, hey, we need a planet version. And so I went from, instead of me going from doing Metamorphosis Alpha to doing a Metamorphosis Alpha accessory, I went to designing Gamma World almost instantly.
Okay.
And because the people just screamed for it. Well, so we did Gamma World, and it became very popular. And Grenadier said, hey, let's do some miniatures. And, you know, again, the naive Jim Ward only got royalties on the sale of Gamma World. He did not get royalties on the sale of any ancillary. Thank you. Ancillary product or item. So like the Gamma World miniatures, I didn't get any money for. The Gamma World modules, I didn't get anything for those either. So I became brighter in my contract negotiations as time went on. But no, Gamma World came out very popular. They said, okay, let's do a bunch of Gamma World things because we don't have to pay royalties on modules and other things. And so that's why Metamorphosis Alpha stopped being made, because it was definitely in competition with Gamma World. People had to make a decision between buying Gamma World or buying Metamorphosis Alpha.
Right, the same way iPads and iPhones can cannibalize each other's sales.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what happened.
Well, let me ask about that one little in-between product, because I remember seeing as a kid the a print ad for Gamma World in which it advertised a forthcoming product for Gamma World that never came out, which was Metamorphosis Alpha to Omega. A version of that, something called that, came out much, much later under, what was that? The Amazing Engine.
Amazing Engine, yeah. So basically, it was going to come out. I was going to write it, but I got wrapped up writing other things. So that's why it never happened.
So, okay.
No, there isn't. I'm sorry.
I'm as bad as anyone else on the internet. I want there to be a story.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, I really appreciate you being on the show. At some point in this podcast, I'm going to have to move on past very good friends, but it's wonderful to have a very good friend on.
No problem, buddy.
And if you would like to write the show, to comment on tonight's episode, or to suggest future guests, you can write us at designers@mudpuppygames.com. And in the show notes on the webpage for this episode will be myriad and multitudinous links on how you can go purchase the Metamorphosis Alpha Deluxe Hardback reprint, Ward Coase paperback facsimile reprint, and all the other goodies. So, Jim, thank you for doing this.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I love doing this kind of thing, and you're a great moderator. So let's do this again on some other topic.
Next Kickstarter, maybe.
All righty.
And that'll wrap it up for this episode. We'll see you next time on Designers and Discourses.
And that's it.